America at a Crossroads is a weekly live webinar series that brings together journalists, scholars, thought leaders, and policymakers for discussions regarding the state of American democracy, where we've been, where we are, and where we're going. The series was jointly founded by Jews United for Democracy and Justice and Community Advocates, Inc. To register for our live webinars, join our email list at JewsUnitedForDemocracy.org.
Now to introduce tonight's guest, please welcome former LA County Supervisor, a key member of our America at a Crossroads leadership team, and my longtime friend, Zev Yaroslavsky. Zev?
Well, thank you, Janice. I'm the other Yaroslav on the program tonight, and I'm very excited to have the opportunity to introduce someone who doesn't need me to spell my last name. Welcome, Yaroslav. It's an honor to have you here. Let me say first, Yaroslav Trofimov was born in Ukraine. He's a chief foreign affairs correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, currently based in Dubai, as you heard. He has been a foreign correspondent for the publication since 1999, covering the Middle East, Africa, and Asia. And he served as the bureau chief in Afghanistan and Pakistan. He has received numerous awards. I'll mention one of them, in which he was a runner-up for the Pulitzer Prize in International Reporting for two consecutive years, in 2023 for his coverage of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and in 2022 for reporting on the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan. He has written three critically reviewed and acclaimed books. The one that just was published last month, Our Enemies Will Vanish, The Russian Invasion and Ukraine's War of Independence. A highly acclaimed book and highly recommended by our team. Two other books he's been noted for is Faith at War, A Journey on the Front Lines of Islam from Baghdad to Timbuktu, and The Siege of Mecca, The Forgotten Uprising in Islam's Holiest Shrine and the Birth of Al-Qaeda. Max Boot will lead the conversation tonight. Max is not a stranger to our America at a Crossroads program. Max is a journalist, editorialist, lecturer, and military historian. Currently, he is the Jean J. Kirkpatrick Senior Fellow in National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and a very frequent contributor to the Washington Post. He has worked for the Christian Science Monitor and the Wall Street Journal and has written for many publications, including the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times. Max has written six books on various military and foreign affairs subjects. His most recent book, The Corrosion of Conservatism, Why I Left the Right, and his seventh book, which is about to be released in September, about Ronald Reagan. Those are two books that I'm, the first of which I highly recommend, and the second of which I'm sure will be as compelling and engaging as the first six he's written. So with that, let me turn it over to Max, who, by the way, received his BA in Berkeley, which should make Mel Levine happy, and his master's from Yale. Max, it's all yours.
Well, it's a pleasure to be back with everybody on this wonderful series of programs, and doubly a pleasure to talk to one of the reporters that I respect most in the world. And when I need to find out what's going on in Ukraine, or just in recent years, or before that, what was going on in Afghanistan or elsewhere, the person I invariably turn to is Yaroslav Trofimov of the Wall Street Journal, and just an outstanding war correspondent and general foreign correspondent. And I think there's a certain, and also the author, of course, of this fantastic book, which I join everybody in recommending. This is, as he says in here, journalism is considered the first draft of history, and this is a second draft. And I know from somebody, from the perspective of somebody like me, who often writes the third draft of history, writing works of history many years after the events, I always find these kinds of books just invaluable because there is so much frontline reporting there that will never be replicated. The things that Yaro saw, and he was out there, in the danger zone for a long period of time. And he's a very acute observer, fine writer, and really gives you a sense of what it was like. But I want to, begin our conversation by noting the elephant in the room, which is that, of course, you are Ukrainian. You've had a very distinguished career reporting on other people's wars, and now you're reporting on a war that's happening in your own homeland. So I'm just curious, how do you think about that? How do you process that? What is this like for you compared to, covering the war in Afghanistan, for example?
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you, Max. And thank you, everyone, for, you know, very kind introductions. It's tough. It's much tougher to cover the attack on the city where you grew up, where every little piece of geography has an emotional meaning to you. You know, the park where you used to go on dates as a teenager, you know, the hospital where your grandmother took you to check out your eyes. So, I remember being in Kyiv and having to wear body armor, a flak jacket and a helmet. It was probably the second week of the war, and staying on an empty street that was clogged with cars. You couldn't find parking there just 2 weeks earlier, and hearing this thud of artillery and thinking, how dare they, really? And so it was a personal insult in a way. But on the other hand, this war, and I've spent, as you said, most of my career professionally covering other people's wars of mayhem, you know, Iraq, Afghanistan, you know, Liberia, you name it. And this is a war that probably has the biggest moral clarity of any conflict we have seen since World War II. You have a clear case of an unprovoked aggression driven by imperial delusions of, you know, Vladimir Putin, the man who convinced himself that Russians and Ukrainians are one people and the Ukrainians will welcome his tanks with flowers, and is ready to kill hundreds of thousands of people to achieve that delusion. And that moral clarity, I think, made it much easier to cover, and also made the issue of, you know, my personal feelings, which I'm trying to keep away from the book, by the way, less relevant, because there was little opportunity for this clash between my sensibility and the obligations of the job to be objective. You know, I just had to write what is happening. It was pretty clear. And I think speaking the languages, because, you know, people in Ukraine speak Ukrainian and Russian, and being able to understand on a sort of visceral level the way people think, the way people express themselves, you know, every little, you know, faint meaning that is sometimes escapes you if you're not from a place, was really helpful. You know, I do speak Arabic, but still I could not claim to understand the fine details of the Iraqi dialect the way I understand the people speak in Donbass. And so I think that really helped in writing this narrative that, you know, penetrates a little bit deeper and explains. And the book is really, it's a story of characters. It's a story of the people who are fighting this war, civilians, soldiers who became soldiers, heroes, traitors also. And I'm just, you know, one reviewer described it as a kind of cinema verite. So I'm just basically your camera lens that is traveling to the front lines and telling these stories through my eyes and putting them in some sort of context and framework to explain how, you know, the overall geopolitics and the history of it all meshes together and explains what's happening now.
What I really like about what you do is that you do report objectively and accurately, but you also report with moral clarity, as you were just stating. And I think those, you know, there's too often there's this myth that correspondents have to be entirely neutral in whatever they're covering. And I don't think that's right. They have to be truthful and they have to, you know, tell it what they see. But I don't think there's anything wrong with understanding that there are larger moral stakes, as was the case with correspondents in World War II. They weren't saying like Nazis, allies, who cares? They understood that there was a larger moral stake. And I think what you bring out is really resonates with me, I have to say, as somebody who also spent a little time in Afghanistan and Iraq and always found those conflicts to be somewhat murky, because quite frankly, the people that we, the United States, were supporting in those places were often corrupt, abusive warlords. They were not nice people. And so to me, it's just like, wow, it's just so nice to be, you know, covering and writing about a war like Ukraine, where there is no doubt that you have good guys and bad guys. Not to say that every Ukrainian is a paragon of virtue or every Russian is the epitome of evil, but in terms of the causes for which they fight, it is, as you say, this is the most clear-cut good versus evil type of conflict we've seen since World War II. I mean, it's not even close. There's no shades of gray. There's nothing that can possibly justify this unprovoked Russian invasion of this peaceful neighbor.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, in journalism, lots of standards of American journalism are come from covering things in a democracy. So, you know, if you cover a civil lawsuit, you know, one party says one thing, another party says another thing, and you have to, you know, you don't know what is the truth. But if, you know, if you are at the scene of a mass murder, it's pretty clear, you know, who's killing whom. So, like, the he said, she said doesn't work. Really, you have to get to the actual truth, because objective truth does exist. It's not just, you know, the Russians say this, the Ukrainians say this, you know, make up your mind. You should go there and see what's happening. And I think that is the value of the book as well, because I did try to go not just in Kiev, where I was, where the war began, but throughout, you know, all the major turning points of the first year of the war and the second year of the war, you know, as they developed, just to bring this eyewitness testimony, because, you know, in lots of places, there was no one who had seen what happened until we arrived.
Yep. And it's a powerful act to witness, because, as you know, and as you document, the Russians and their apologists in the West just lie relentlessly 24/7, just this steady spew of bullshit about what's going on. And people like you are really performing an incredibly valuable role by saying, going there and seeing with your own eyes and saying, no, this is what's actually happening. It's not this bullshit. You guys are saying this is the actual truth. That's just a very powerful act of courage and witness, I think.
Thank you. And you know, the what really struck me is the power, the emotional power of that Russian propaganda. And I'm writing a book, you know, I was in Kharkiv, you know, Ukraine's second largest city, that was shelled day and night in the first weeks of the war. It's like, again, being attacked pretty much every day now. And then I remember talking to a woman there whose father lived in Russia. And she told him, you know, look, my home has been bombarded. You know, I'm living in the subway station for 2 weeks now, 3 weeks. And he told her, no, it's impossible. I'm watching television. They're telling us, you know, it's the Nazis. And so even on the family level, you know, people would rather believe what they see on these propaganda channels than what they hear from their own children. And so imagine how it affects people who don't have an immediate connection, who don't know people in Ukraine.
Yeah, I want to get to the events of the last few weeks and what's going to happen in the near future. But first, I want to talk about some of the stuff that you chronicle in your book, which, as you said, is really the first and second year of the war. And it really brought back to me very powerfully a sense of how improbable everything that unfolded actually was. And I mean, you describe and make us remember how everybody expected the Ukrainians to fold within a matter of days and the Russians to march into Kiev, and you show why that didn't happen. Were you surprised by the way it worked out, or did you, like so many of us, kind of expect that Russia would win in relatively short order?
Well, you know, so I spent most of the previous year in Afghanistan. I was in Kabul on August 15th, 2021, you know, and I remember how the previous evening, President Ashraf Ghani, you know, then American citizen, you know, whose children never came to Afghanistan, remained in New York, toured the troops, said, we will fight to the last man, you know, the city will not fall. And by lunchtime the next day, the Taliban were in my hotel, and Ashraf Ghani was in a helicopter on his way here to the United Arab Emirates. And so, and I, you know, I had this fear, what would the Ukrainian president do? You know, would he stand and fight? You know, he's not a warrior. You know, he was a comedian in his previous career. And so I came to Ukraine in January 2022 and toured the country. And I went to the east, and I went to Kharkiv, Donbass, just to gauge what is the sentiment. And I was struck by how in all these regions in eastern Ukraine that are mostly Russian-speaking, that used to have a pretty solid strand of opinion that backed Russia, was influenced by the Kremlin propaganda, and generally was pro-Russian, back in 2014, when after the Maidan Revolution, when the war really began with the, you know, with the annexation of Crimea and the proxy war in Donbass. So, I was struck by how that pro-Russian public opinion had disappeared in the 8 years, because, you know, Russia was seen as this country that would bring higher salaries and prosperity back in 2014. And then in the 8 years of occupation in Donbass, everybody had seen that it's not true. Everybody had seen that Russia means, you know, gangland violence, destruction of the economy. And actually most people in Donbass, in the Russian occupied Donbass, had voted with their feet. They fled to the rest of Ukraine, to Europe, to Russia. And everybody knew that, you know, in Kharkiv, you know, 100,000 people there were 100,000 refugees from Donbass at the time. And I was pretty confident that Ukraine will not fold as easily as people predict, because both the Kremlin and Washington had gotten Ukraine wrong. So this whole idea that the Russian-speaking Ukrainians were less patriotic than Ukrainian-speaking Ukrainians, that they are looking to Moscow, was not true anymore. There used to be this cleavage in the past, to an extent, but it had disappeared by this lived experience of watching what happens when Russia comes to your home in Donbass. 8 years had passed, people knew what it means. And so, so when I was in Kiev, and you know, the book starts with me being warned by the previous president of Ukraine, Poroshenko, the night before the invasion, well, the afternoon before the invasion, he's telling me that, hey, you know, the war will be tomorrow morning. It's your time to get to the airport, hop on the plane out, while you still can. And obviously, you know, I had come there to see and watch and witness it. And I was pretty confident that Kiev will not fold. And when Zelensky made his famous recording on the second night of the war, sort of he came out outside his office with the camera and saying, you know, we are all here. We're not going anywhere. It really galvanized everyone. And I remember driving through Kyiv the next morning and seeing thousands of people coming out of the apartment blocks just to pick up weapons and go to the front line. And I think, you know, that morning, you know, I realized that, you know, there is no way the Russians will take Kyiv. But, you know, people didn't believe that. People didn't believe in Washington, and people didn't believe in Moscow. And, you know, that is why Ukraine did not get any military help of meaningful military help from the U.S. Before the war began. You know, the U.S. had supplied 90 Javelin anti-tank missiles to Ukraine before the invasion against an army of thousands and thousands of tanks and armored personnel carriers and fighting vehicles coming across the border. So it was really symbolical. And the weaponry that the U.S. provided at the time was really for an insurgency, because everybody expected Kyiv to collapse.
Right. But instead of collapsing, what actually happened, as we know and as you describe, is that the Ukrainians held the lines, the Russians had to retreat from Kyiv. And then, of course, you had the sequel, which occurred in the fall of 2022, when the Ukrainians had this seemingly miraculous success of their counteroffensive, liberating huge swaths of Kharkiv province, as well as in Kherson, and really driving the Russians back. And one of the points you've made is that this was sort of a missed opportunity from the standpoint of Ukraine and the West, because you know, perhaps the Ukrainians could have kept going if they had only received the kind of weaponry before that they were to receive subsequently. And, you know, the West is so slow to arm the Ukrainians, there was a limit to what they could do. Do you look upon that as kind of a turning point in hindsight?
Well, this was definitely a missed opportunity to end the war, or at least to end the war, to put Ukraine in a much more favorable position than it is now. If we recall the history of it, the nuclear threats that Putin had made at the very beginning of the war, the first morning of the war, he went on TV and said, you know, if you dare to interfere in my special military operation, you will see the response the likes you have never seen before. And they didn't stop the U.S. And allies from supplying weapons, but really throttled the kind of support that was given. Because the first consideration was, do not provoke the Russians too much. Do not lead them to escalate. And nobody knew what the Russian red lines were. So the Russians were kind of allowed to set the agenda. And so little by little, you know, the U.S. got bolder and bolder and gave the Ukrainians the capabilities. You know, first the Western artillery towards the summer, then the HIMARS missiles. And now even, you know, the F-16 fighter jets, and the latest we've heard from President Biden is that the ATACMS long-range missiles are also coming, or have already come to Ukraine, actually, in the last 2 weeks. All of that was unthinkable in the beginning. And when sort of the first wave of the war ended with this failed Russian blitzkrieg on Kyiv, and the Russians regrouped, Putin refused to acknowledge that his special military operation, quote-unquote, is not going to plan, so he wasn't mobilizing. So by September 2022, Russia had only about 100,000 combat troops in Ukraine. So Ukraine, for the first time, had a massive manpower advantage. What they didn't have was weapons. They didn't have enough ammo. It certainly didn't have the tanks, the fighting vehicles, or aircraft for that matter. And so when it broke through the Russian lines, exploiting its manpower advantage, it just couldn't develop this offensive far enough. And then Russia mobilized hundreds of thousands of reservists. Russia built minefields, Russia built fortifications. And so when all these weapons arrived the following year in 2023, it was just too late. The war had changed and the Ukrainian counteroffensive didn't really achieve any great success. And so the one comparison I keep hearing from Ukrainian commanders is that this war is like a fire. You know, to extinguish a fire, you need a bucket of water. And the US had given us a bucket of water, but in little teacups over 2 years.
So what do you attribute the failure of this vaunted Ukrainian counteroffensive? I mean, in kind of in hindsight, looking at the strength of Russian fortifications with minefields and all the rest of it, the Ukrainians just didn't have a prayer of breaking through. And yet there was a widespread expectation. I know talking to senior officials in Washington, as you did, there was an expectation that they would break through to the Sea of Azov and break the so-called Russian land bridge in Ukraine, which they never came close to doing. Was that, how do you explain that failure?
There are several explanations. I think, first of all, the nature of war has changed. If we look at the front lines in Ukraine, they haven't really moved much since November 2022. So all the games were set in the first several months of the war, because the drone technology that is really revolutionary in Ukraine, and it's, I think the U.S. military has yet to realize how it transformed the nature of the battlefield, has made any mass movements of armor, you know, the wanted combined arms of warfare that is part of the U.S. doctrine, very, very difficult, probably impossible, because, you know, any group of tanks or fighting vehicles that starts moving gets discovered within minutes and destroyed within minutes. And so the fighting is more and more in small groups. Concentrations are no longer possible. And, you know, we've seen the Russians try this, you know, large assaults and get destroyed. And the Ukrainians also get destroyed. So that's one reason. Another reason is that, yes, the Russians had spent, you know, the entire winter building these minefields, fortifications that made it much harder to cross. The third, the Russians had adapted. The Russian military is much better than it was before, both in terms of its tactics, but also they have learned how to deal with American weapons. The fact that American weapons were introduced in small numbers to test the waters slowly gave the Russians the time to develop countermeasures. So, you know, the famous HIMARS are no longer as effective as now because the Russians have learned how to jam their targeting systems and how to divert them. Same with the JDAMs, you know, the guided bombs. And so the Russians just, you know, are effective. And some of the Western weapons are not as good as people thought they are once they tried in the battlefield. You know, the Abrams and the Leopard tanks haven't really shown themselves to be all that effective in this war.
How would you assess the correlation of forces today after more than 2 years of war? Because, as you note, you know, at first there was an expectation that the Russians would win quickly, and then it seemed like the Ukrainians would win, and now we're in the stalemate phase. And the Russians seem to have gotten much stronger. They've enlarged their forces. As you say, they've also learned some things. They're not quite as stupid as they were at the beginning. They're showing greater capabilities than they were. And then the Ukrainians have just been kind of ground down, especially because so many of these Ukrainian units have been at the front for 2 years. They're getting depleted by casualties. They're getting tired, demoralized. How do you assess the balance of forces today?
Well, let's talk about what happened, you know, in the past, let's say five, six months since the end of the Ukrainian attempt at the counteroffensive. So back in October last year, the Ukrainian military had a parity in ammunition. So for every shell that the Ukrainians were firing, that they were getting one shell back from the Russians, maybe even less. And then the U.S. support dropped off the cliff. At the same time, Russia got ballistic missiles from North Korea, ammunition, more than a million shells from North Korea, more and more drones from Iran. And so Russia really, really had a massive firepower advantage over the past 5 months, I would say. It's probably like right now it's 10 to 1 shells. So for every shell Ukrainians fire, they get 10 back. And despite all that, despite all this, difficulty of being able to resist, really, like, you know, what do you fight with? Ukraine lost only small bits of territory so far. You know, it lost one town, Avdiivka, population of 30,000 before the war. The Russians, by the admission of, you know, one of Russian officers themselves, lost 16,000 people to get this one town. It's a lot of people. It's more than Russia lost in even in its 9 years of war in Afghanistan. The Soviet Union, actually, not just Russia. And so it's difficult. Ukraine certainly has issues with recruitment and manpower. That's why they've changed the mobilization law. They're trying to woo the Ukrainian citizens abroad to come back and fight. You know, Ukraine just announced the other day that it will not renew passports of military-aged males who are abroad unless they come home and regularize their situation with the military. But the weapons are now supposedly on the way. You know, President Biden did sign this $60 billion appropriation bill for Ukraine this morning. And I think there's a renewed optimism in Ukraine that the tide will be turned again and that Ukraine will be able to hold off this Russian advance and maybe even push back.
What do you think the concrete impact is going to be of the renewed flow of U.S. weaponry? Is it basically going to be to stabilize the stalemate, or is it going to, is there a chance of actually changing facts on the ground? And in particular, and not necessarily on the ground, but also in other areas. Like, I mean, we've seen in the last 6+ months that the Ukrainians have had tremendous success in opening up the Black Sea to their commerce, driving back the Russian fleet. In recent months, they've been targeting Russian refineries very deep in Russia with their drones. Now that they're getting the long-range attack guns, they're starting to target Russian bases in Crimea. So how does all this shake out? Is there... What do you think is going to happen in the next, say, 6 months or so?
Yeah, well, a stalemate would be good for Ukraine right now, because right now Russia is advancing. Every couple of days it takes a village or two, and at least stabilizing the front line in Donbass would be Ukraine's top priority right now. And obviously having the ammunition, having artillery shells, it's critical. And it's not just that, you know, I mean, the latest package announced by the White House includes Bradley fighting vehicles, includes lots of stuff that Ukraine really needs. The bottleneck in ammunition is production, because both the US and the European countries have been very slow in putting their economies on the war footing. I'm talking about the military industries and really ramping up this production. Unlike Russia, which has been able to dramatically increase it. And so, there won't really be enough artillery ammunition for Ukraine to start offensive operations until probably early next year. You know, by then, the European production will kick in and will be able to fuel the Ukrainian demand. So I think the planning in Ukraine for now, as far as conventional ground war is, to try to hold the line, maybe exploit some tactical, you know, opportunities here and there, but really prepare for the big push next year. But who knows? You know, war is unpredictable, obviously. So you mentioned these drone strikes. I mean, the Ukraine is prohibited by the U.S. from using any of the American weapons on Russian territory, which, if you think of it, is basically making Ukraine fight with one hand tied behind its back. Because if you're sitting in Kharkiv, which is 40 miles from the border, and you're getting pummeled day and night by stuff fired from Russia, you're not allowed to fire back with American weapons. How do you defend a city like this? And, you know, Russia is firing pretty much every day cruise missiles, ballistic missiles, strike drones at Ukrainian infrastructure, Ukrainian cities, port facilities, residential buildings. And Ukraine is not allowed to fire any of the cruise missiles it got from the UK or France, or the ATACMS it got now from the US at Russia. So Ukraine has had to develop its own military industry that's focusing on drones. And, you know, Ukraine has a big tradition of aircraft manufacturing. You know, the world's biggest aircraft, Antonov, was made in Ukraine and destroyed in the first weeks of the war. And so, the Soviet Union's main aircraft engine manufacturers in Ukraine is Zaporizhia. And so Ukraine has dozens of companies that do make these drones that really have developed this remarkable ability to strike very deep in Russia, more than 1,000 miles in the latest ones. And they do target oil refineries, other strategic infrastructure, and they try to hit Russian airfields because obviously the best air defense is to destroy your enemy's planes.
How much success do you think Ukraine is going to have in mobilizing a large number of new soldiers? And obviously this has been a sore point. It's been the legislation has been passed in the parliament, but it took a long time to get there. And General Zaluzhny, as you know, the previous commander of Ukrainian forces, suggested they needed to mobilize 400,000 to 500,000 troops. And President Zelensky, rejected that, said it was too expensive and presumably too unpopular. But do you think that's a ballpark for what they actually need to mobilize? And what do you think they'll actually be able to do?
Well, I mean, the size of the Ukrainian armed forces right now is about 1 million people. So, which is a lot for a country of probably 35 million in the country right now. And they are mobilizing more. It's even without this law, every day people will be mobilized in Ukraine, both volunteers and people who are conscripted. This law lowered the minimum age for mobilization somewhat from 27 to 25. But the problem in Ukraine and Russia is there's this really skewed demographic situation. Now, for every man who's in his early 20s, there are 2.5 men who are in their 40s and 50s. People just didn't have children in the 1990s, when the economy in Ukraine and in Russia was imploding. And so unlike, the trenches of World War I, which were filled with the lost generation of 20-year-olds, Ukraine's trenches are filled and Russia's trenches are filled with the 40, 50-year-olds, sometimes with bad backs and lots of, chronic diseases. So it's really a different kind of war. And there aren't that many young people to send to the army. That's the problem for both countries, actually.
Right. Let me turn now to, we have a whole bunch of questions, a lot of good questions. So let me turn to our audience and throw some of these at you. Jim asks, there have been calls for war, for the war to end with peace negotiations. Do you believe that's possible? And if so, would Ukraine have to give up any territory? And what happens with Crimea? And I would add with Donbass, and obviously this has been a very sore point in any talk about ending the war, and with Ukrainians overwhelmingly rejecting any territorial concessions up until now. But I've seen some weakening in public opinion polls in terms of whether how many Ukrainians are willing to give up land for peace. But what's your view of that?
Well, I think, first of all, let's look at what Russia's goals are. Russia's goals, I think, have not changed since the war began. And that goal is to destroy Ukraine as a country. So, when Tucker Carlson, went on his pilgrimage to Vladimir Putin, in Moscow, Putin spent, the first half of the conversation telling him how Ukraine doesn't really exist. It's a made-up country. The Ukrainian language was invented by the Austro-Hungarian intelligence, and it's all really Russia. And that is the thinking, he wants Kyiv, he wants Odessa, he wants Kharkiv, and he's not ready to accept Ukraine as a truly independent state. And as long as that's the case, we're not talking about territorial concessions. We're just talking about the existence of the Ukrainian statehood. The Ukrainian reluctance to strike any more deals on dismembering the country stems from history, because there were already two deals. In 2014 and 15, when Russia first invaded, Ukraine gave up control over parts of Donbass just to have Russia invade again in 2022. So the possibility of any peace negotiations, I think, is very, very remote right now.
So what happens with this war? I mean, does it just keep grinding on indefinitely?
Well, it sort of depends on what happens in the battlefield. As long as, there is some sort of dynamic stalemate, both sides hope that they can win it. If the Russians break through the front lines that are at the doorstep of Kyiv again, then there would be a deal, but it would be a capitulation of Ukraine. It would not be a peace deal. It would be a surrender. And obviously, if the Ukrainians manage to break through, then the Russians will have to maybe sort of revisit their position. But long term, I could quite foresee a scenario of this going on for a long time, because again, stalemate is better than defeat. And the consequences of Ukraine defeat will be monumental, not just for Ukraine, but for the rest of Europe, for NATO, and for the US. And so ultimately, I think it's probably going to be decided by the internal situation in both countries. So because the pressures of conflicts are invisible in Russia, but they are there. You know, we have seen it with the Prigozhin uprising last year. You know, hundreds of thousands of people have died or were maimed at this war. And so at some point, there should be some social reaction to that. So will Russia crack first? Will Ukraine crack first because of its casualties, because of its own political problems? It's hard to tell. It also depends on the level of Western help that Ukraine will continue receiving. You know, it's in the West, not an observer here. The West is, you know, quite actively part of this conflict, even though no American or Western soldiers are dying there. You know, lots of Russians were killed with Russian, with American money and American weapons. And so, in the First World War, at the end of the day, that's what determined the course of the war. You know, Russia imploded, and then Germany imploded. So
that brings me to a question that was asked by Barr and others. Reports indicate that the $60 billion will only provide 6 months of support. Is it plausible to continue this war in light of the huge expense, both in terms of weaponry and soldiers? Russia seems to be a bottomless pit in terms of weapons and soldiers. Is it realistic to rely on $60 billion in U.S. aid every 6 months to keep Ukraine going?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's not just the U.S. that's providing the assistance. And the Europeans have really stepped up in the last year, in part because they were scared that U.S. money will not come through. I think former President Trump's words back in February, when he said that he would encourage Russia to invade NATO members that don't pay their dues, were really like a cold shower on Europeans and forced a lot of rethinking. And we've seen the French even speaking about sending troops to Ukraine. President Macron said that the war in Ukraine is existential for European security and for French security. Not the kind of language you've heard before. And Russia is not a bottomless pit. If you look at the attrition statistics, long-term attrition works in Ukraine's favor, because for every tank or fighting vehicle or howitzer that Russia makes or refurbishes from its Soviet stocks, it loses 3 right now in the front line. So at some point in a year or two, it will just run out. And unlike Ukraine, Russia has nowhere else to get this gear. Nobody else is going to give it tanks. This just doesn't have any external supplier for most of this equipment, unless China really joins the conflict, which it hasn't so far militarily, and has lots of reasons not to in the future, just because it would be dramatic for China's economy and its ability to trade with the rest of the world. And so Russia is in a sweet position this year because of the gaps in American funding and because the Western manufacturing capacity needs time to catch up. But it probably wouldn't be the next year.
Well, that brings me to a question that a number of listeners have asked, which is, what happens to Ukraine if Trump, God forbid, wins the election in November?
Well, I'll be the last person to judge, what Trump may do, because as we all know, it's hard to predict. But we can see what has happened so far. For one reason or another, he stood aside and gave a blinking, light, not a red light for sure, to Speaker Johnson, pushing through the $60 billion for Ukraine. I'm not privy to what happened in their conversations, but it's clear that, had he wanted to stop this, he would have spoken against it. He didn't. In the statement he made just before the vote, a couple of days before the vote, he said that the Europeans are not doing enough. The Europeans should do more. The Europeans, unlike us, we have an ocean between us and Russia. So it's not our direct threat to us, but it is for the Europeans. For them, Ukraine's survival and strength are important, but they're also important to us. So this, I think the signaling of him that he has made for the first time, saying that Ukraine's strength is important for the U.S., was a very important message that really resulted in the fact that this legislation was passed overwhelmingly in the House and especially in the Senate, where quite a few, I think 7 Senate members flipped from the first vote, from a no, you know, February to a yes now. But you know, we'll see what happens. I mean, former President Trump, you know, has said that he has this peace deal in mind, and you know, he will strike a deal in 24 hours. You know, we all have to have peace in 24 hours. It's kind of hard to achieve.
Well, sadly, the only track record he has of striking deals to end wars was in Afghanistan, where he struck a very one-sided deal that basically laid the groundwork for a Taliban takeover. So that's not a great precedent if you care about the future of Ukraine. We have a number of questions about the Republican Party, and along the lines of one listener asking, how do you explain how the Republicans went from being so anti-Russia to becoming apologists for Putin and pro-Russia like they are now? I mean, I would say that's not all Republicans, but it's certainly a substantial number within the party. It's slightly more than half of the House Republicans.
Yeah, but, you know, less than half of the Senate Republicans, as per latest vote. I think, you know, if you look at the appeal of Russia and appeal of Putin, sort of the strongman image, his whole message of, you know, I'm the protector of traditional values, and playing in America's culture wars and Western culture wars, you know, that's been going on for a long time. And it's, you know, it's quite hypocritical. Obviously, I mean, Russia, if you look at the Russian society with its divorce rates, with its, you know, teenage pregnancy rates, with its crime rates, you know, it's not a paragon of Christian values by any means. However, that messaging sold, and it still sells. And the further away you are from Russia or Ukraine, the better it sells, because you just don't know what's happening. And so to me, the interesting dynamic was that in Europe, it was also, you know, pretty strong. You know, a lot of far-right parties in Europe, you know, the League in Italy, you know, the Le Pen's party in France, they're all very openly pro-Putin. You know, Salvini, you know, the head of the Lega in Italy, was wearing a Putin t-shirt, you know, on trips to Moscow. And all that is no longer on the surface. So people in Europe and the far-right in Europe are ashamed of being seen as pro-Putin. Because the war in Ukraine for Europeans is a real thing. You know, every European country is hosting millions and millions of Ukrainian refugees, mostly women and children. And it's just shameful to be backing a war, because Ukraine is not an abstraction. In America, Ukraine is an abstraction. You know, most people have not had to deal with Ukrainian refugees, house them in their homes, you know, employ them in their jobs. So they're not exposed to you know, this human side of the story. And so Putin still remains, you know, this symbol of, you know, and factor in the cultural wars. And it's really striking that influence that's, you know, his ideology has in the U.S. versus Europe, because Europe, let's remember it, had to pay a very significant economic price to sort of, you know, severe dependence on Russian energy, and to really pose sanctions, and it's bearing a cost. And, you know, there's a huge economic lobby in Europe that is would like to resume relations with Russia, and it's losing money because of that. Nobody in America, or very few people in America, are losing money because of Russia, because the U.S. never had this dependence to begin with. And yet, politically, you do have this very strong pro-Russian lobby that really repeats Russian talking points verbatim.
No, I mean, I think that's an important point to make, is that we do tend to focus on the strength of the pro-Russian lobby here, but we kind of take for granted that the Europeans are largely united in support of Ukraine, and that is not something that would have been at all predictable prior to the war. You would have expected it might have gone the other way. So it's kind of a good news, bad news story. Let me ask you another question, this one from Susan. How much, quote unquote, real news do the majority of the Russian population receive about, especially about deaths and injuries of Russian troops? And is there any large group of people in Russia who are against the war?
Well, I mean, you know, Russia doesn't have full censorship. So, you know, if you want to go on social media, on Telegram, you know, you can read all the news you want. You know, it's true, yes, the state TV is, you know, broadcasting, you know, propaganda, and the Russians are really good at propaganda. I mean, that's the one skill set that they've honed and developed since the end of the Cold War, and they're still a global superpower in propaganda. And, you know, even me, if I watch Russian TV for a few hours, you know, my brain starts fizzling and like, oh, really? So what has been really surprising is the fact that this huge toll of the war has not so far caused outrage or any sort of social upheaval in Russia. You know, there's no protesting mothers, there's no demonstrations. Everybody accepts it, or seems to accept it as a given. And I think part of that is the result of this transformation of sort of the Russian, the cult of victory in the World War II. Because basically what happened in Russia is that May 9th, the day of, you know, the Nazi capitulation to the Soviets in 1945, is the biggest holiday of the year. And this victory is really a national religion. It's become so under Putin. So, you know, people on the 9th of May go to the streets and they carry the portraits of their grandparents who were killed fighting the Nazis. And, you know, we did it once, we can do it again. And this Cold War is cast in Russia as a sequel to the Second World War. And generations raised in the idea, well, you know, my grandfather has died, you know, for the freedom of Russia, and now it's our turn. And I think it's accepted by society to a great extent. So because it's all portrayed in this prism of, you know, we're fighting the Nazis again in an existential war. And that is the message that does resonate, unfortunately, with Russians. And on the other hand, because the borders are open, you know, a lot of people who disagree with what's going on just left the country, especially after the mobilization in September 2022. About a million Russian people fled because they didn't want to fight in Ukraine.
One of the other questions from Jonathan is, how can the West best help the Russian public learn the truth about this war? And I guess that's on the assumption that if they learn the truth, they will turn against it, which, as you suggest, is not necessarily the case.
Right. You know, the people who want to know the truth. I think, you know, people in Nazi Germany probably knew the truth of what's going on. You know, people in Stalin's Soviet Union, most of them knew what was going on. It's just more convenient not to know, because if you do acknowledge the facts, then, you know, you have to act on them, and that's dangerous. And so people's coping mechanism is just to deny reality. And that's, you know, going back to that father who was, you know, telling his daughter, like, I don't believe that the Russians are bombing your house. Because if he did believe that, he would have to go on the street and protest. And that's dangerous.
Right. I mean, of course, the big difference, and you're certainly right about the way Putin kind of weaponizes the Soviet victory in World War II to his own advantage. But of course, the big difference is, you know, in World War II, the Soviet Union was actually invaded. Here, they're the ones who are doing the invading. So that would seem like a pretty large difference because, I mean, even as you know, there was a lot of people who were very unhappy with the Stalin regime. I mean, people in Ukraine, for example, who were victims of a collectivization genocide in the 1930s. And yet the fact that Hitler invaded Russia, the fact that Hitler was so brutal in his occupation of Russia, basically united Russians behind Stalin and the war effort. Whereas right now, they're united seemingly behind a war that Putin has launched for no good reason. It's still kind of astonishing that that's the case.
Yeah, but that's how we see it, right? You know, on Russian propaganda, you know, Russia did not start the war. You know, when Putin announced the invasion, well, his special military operation, he said, we're not beginning wars, we're ending them. You know, so it is portrayed as Russia's self-defense against the collective West that's going to destroy Moscow any day. You know, in the U.S., you know, we say that we're not fighting this war. You know, we're not involved directly. But, you know, for Russians, you know, they are fighting what Putin calls the collective West.
Yeah, it's, you know, to use the overused term, it's Orwellian how Putin has inverted reality. There's a number of questions here about nuclear weapons. And do you think that Russia will use nuclear weapons? Do you think that Russia's nuclear arsenal actually works? You know, how seriously should we take these Russian threats?
Well, obviously, Russia wants them to be taken very, very seriously. And, you know, there was a moment that I described in the book in September 2022 where Russian threats of nuclear use really, really throttled American help. And if you remember, what happened is that once Russian lines were, Ukraine broke through the Russian lines, Russia just declared all those areas to be Russian sovereign territory and then said, you know, well, if you attack it, we'll be attacking Russia and we'll use all weapons at our disposal. And Putin said, this is not a bluff. And then Ukraine went ahead anyway and took Kherson and took Lyman. And obviously, Russia did not use nuclear weapons. And at the time, there was a lot of intercepts of Russian communications suggesting that it was planning maybe to use the weapons. Now we know that all those intercepts were meant to be intercepted. It was all part of the psychological operations by the Kremlin. Can Russia use nuclear weapons one day? Possible. What would be the consequence of it? Probably terrible for Russia. And using tactical nuclear weapons in Ukraine, it's such a large country, would not really help it achieve military objectives and would completely undermine its relationship with China and India. And it really kind of survives an economy without Chinese help nowadays. And so there are a lot of reasons for Russia not to do that. Again, if you establish the principle that a nuclear power can invade a country and then use nuclear blackmail to just hold on to territory, where does it stop? Does it stop in Berlin, in London? Why not invade Poland next day and say, okay, well, if you fight me back, I'll nuke you. So, and that's why at the end of the day, the U.S., while deterred to a degree, was not completely deterred by these threats.
Where it stops or where it winds up is with a lot of nations getting nuclear weapons because they're going to see that as the ultimate tool of their own self-defense.
They're on the lead in the U.S. protecting them.
For sure. Yeah, right. Which is certainly very much open to doubt at this point, I would say. Carol has a question about using the frozen Russian funds, and there's about $300 billion in Russian assets being held in the West, primarily in Belgium, actually. And the House bill that was just passed by the Senate includes a provision called the Repo Act, which calls on President Biden to send frozen Russian assets in the U.S. to Ukraine. Do you think that's going to happen? Do you think there's going to be a broader use of frozen Russian assets going to Ukraine from Europe?
Well, I don't know if it will happen. There's certainly growing pressure to do so. And it's not just the issue of money itself. It's the political signal that it sends. Because right now, there is still a possibility in the minds of many people in the West of striking a deal and going back to normal with Russia, reopening trade, et cetera, et cetera. The moment you take this money and spend it, it becomes infeasible. Because then, if you want to give it back to Russia, you have to take it from your own taxpayers. And that's just political suicide. And that's why so many people are pressuring to do this, to send a strong signal to Russia that there will not be a return to business as usual. And, the Ukrainian victory and survival is critical to the West's own strategic interests.
Yeah, this is another one of these issues, like with the longer range weapons. And in fact, almost every weapon system, we've been so slow to give the Ukrainians what they need. And this is another one where we've been so slow to send the frozen Russian funds to Ukraine. I mean, this is it's astonishing to me, given that this is such an important struggle, not just for Ukraine, but for the entire West. And I feel like we're constantly holding ourselves back by being reluctant to do what it takes to help Ukraine prevail.
Well, I think it all stems from the failure of imagination in the West, in the U.S. and in Europe, and failure to imagine just how radical the Russian goals are. Nobody believed he would invade because, why would he? It's so obviously self-defeating and counterproductive. It's bad for the economy, and he did. And lots of people don't believe he would. If he wins in Ukraine, he would move on to the Baltic states or Poland if he can, because why would he? It's just so ridiculous. But yet the logic of the Russian expansion is different. And this failure of imagining just how far Russia can go is driving this perception that, well, maybe he's a rational man in the end, he will settle for something, we could do a deal. And so let's not just spend this Russian money for now, because that's a step of no return.
Yep. call it the Trump delusion. I see that we are getting close to the end of the hour, but there's one more question I want to throw out to you, and it's basically a feel-good question, because this listener asked about the transformation of Ukrainian society, which, as he points out, in the past was known for anti-Semitism, among other things, and of course now it has a Jewish president, and I would add it also has a Muslim minister of defense. What brought about this transformation of Ukrainian society? How did it become so multicultural, so liberal?
Well, I think there are two reasons. I mean, first of all, Ukraine as a society, luckily for, despite all the horrors of World War II, managed to maintain a multi-ethnic character, in part because many Ukrainian Jews, including my grandmother, managed to flee east when the Nazis arrived. So they had somewhere to go. They survived and they came back to Ukraine. And, as you rightly point, Ukrainian nationalism in the 1930s, like I think almost all the nationalisms in Europe at the time, was a very nasty blood and soil exclusionary nationalism that was also very anti-Semitic. Let's face the facts. And also very anti-Polish. I think what happened in the 60s and the 70s was remarkable, because Ukrainian dissidents who were in the camps in Gulag were in the same camps as the Jewish refuseniks like Nathan Sharansky, who's from Ukraine and a big supporter of Ukraine, and as the Russian dissidents and as others from the Soviet Union. And there was this rethinking what it means to be Ukrainian. And you had the same in Poland. The Polish dissidents living in Paris who ran the Kultura magazine, thought hard about how to reconcile with the Ukrainians, and they decided that Poland will not demand its lost territories, and the future of Poland can only be guaranteed by independent Ukraine. So there was a reconciliation there as well. And so when Ukraine became independent, it really chose to say that Ukrainians are everyone who lives in Ukraine. It doesn't matter what religion you practice, what language you speak, what blood you have. If you work for Ukraine, you're a Ukrainian. And that is very revolutionary, because it redefined the Soviet concept of nationalities, where everybody's ethnicity was written in the documents. So Zelensky was not a Ukrainian under Soviet law. And I think this almost American sense of citizenship, nationality, is the reason why Ukraine survived in this war, because all these cleavages along religious and language lines did not cause it to implode when the Russians invaded, as the Russians expected. And indeed, we have a Jewish president, and it's never been an issue politically, and he won 3/4 of the vote in 2019. There is a minister of defense who's Muslim, and I would add the head of the armed forces is actually originally from Russia, and he came to Ukraine as an adult. And, none of that is an issue, because they all seen as working for Ukraine.
That's a great success story, and long, long may it endure. I think we're at the end of our hour, but this has been a fantastic conversation. Again, I think listeners are saying why there's nobody I trust more than Yara to explain what's going on in Ukraine, and just a tremendous wealth of knowledge which he brings to bear with his crystal clarity and his moral sense. And I encourage everybody to go out and buy this book, which really tells the truth of what happened in the first couple of years of the war in Ukraine, which sets up what is happening right now. And, please, on behalf of America at the Crossroads, please support these programs by making a donation today. And you should have access to a link on your screen. So thank you very much, Yara. It's truly a pleasure to talk with you. And I look forward to reading more of your writing in the journal.
Likewise, look forward to your book.
Thank you.